Good afternoon, and welcome to today's program commemorating the 30th anniversary of the Gulf War, in which we look at Operation Desert Storm from the perspective of an extraordinary exhibit at the Army Heritage and Education Center at the Army War College in Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania. The Pritzker Military Museum and Library is once again open to the public with reduced capacity and social distancing protocols in place. However, we will continue to offer virtual programming in an effort to keep our guests, staff, and constituents safe and healthy. Before we begin, I would like to take a moment to thank our members and donors for their support of the museum and library. We are proud to be a part of your military history exploration. In this webinar format, you can post questions or comments in the Q&A feed, and we will address some of these at the end. This program is being recorded and will be available for streaming on our website. I am John Allen J. Williams, a retired Navy Reserve Captain, Loyola University Chicago Political Science Professor Emeritus, and member of the Board of Directors of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. I am delighted to welcome today's guests, Mr. Jeff Hawks and Ms. Molly Bompain from the Army Heritage Center Foundation and the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center. Molly Bompain began her Army Museum career working at the 1st Armored Division Museum in Baumholder, Germany. In 2007, she joined the staff of the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center as the curator of photography. In 2012, Ms. Bompain accepted the position of Chief Curator, U.S. Army Europe, in Wiesbaden, Germany. In 2017, she returned to the Army Heritage and Education Center as the Curator of Arms and Ordnance, and served as the curator and team lead for their latest exhibition, This Will Not Stand, the U.S. Army's Road to Victory During the Persian Gulf War, which opened in November 2020. Jeff Hawks is the Education Director for the Army Heritage Center Foundation. A former adjunct professor of political science at the University of Connecticut and Eastern Connecticut State University, Mr. Hawks holds a BA in philosophy and an MA in political science from the University of Connecticut and is a Pennsylvania certified social studies, English language arts, and earth and space science teacher. He is also a veteran U.S. Army infantryman with service in the Gulf War and at the Korean Demilitarized Zone. Good afternoon, Jeff and Molly, and thank you for joining us virtually today.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
Molly, why don't we start with you? Why don't you give us an overview of what the Army History and Education Center is? I am looking forward to visiting it someday, and especially the exhibition that you're curating that is related to Operation Desert Storm.
Well, thank you, Jay. It's great to be here with the Pritzker folks, and I'd like to say welcome to any Desert Storm veterans we have out there. And it's, as you said, it's the 30th anniversary of the ground war today. And I come to you from the United States Army Heritage and Education Center located in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. We're part of the Army War College located on Carlisle Barracks. And we have a fantastic facility. We have a world-class collection. We have an archive, a library, and interpretive spaces and galleries. We have an outdoor trail. And we provide support to the United States Army, to the United States Army War College, and to the public, delivering both historical and contemporary materials to educate the public and the Army. And we're excited to, our latest exhibition was to commemorate the 30th anniversary of the Gulf War. And I'm excited to be here today to talk about it.
Why don't you tell us somewhat about the exhibition? I noticed that there's a lot of parts to it. If people go online, they can look at the exhibition virtually, but also there's an overview of what the various component parts are of the exhibition. It's really quite thorough.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's a fascinating story, Jay. And, you know, it's interesting, being of a certain age, a lot of us remember the Gulf War wherever we were in our lives. And we also remember what was going on at the time and the feeling. But if you think about it, it's been 30 years. So anyone under 30 years of age doesn't have that same memory. And if you think about how many soldiers deployed, to the Persian Gulf. We have over 500,000 U.S. soldiers and the size of the coalition. It's an important part of the Army memory. And we look to our collection, we develop exhibit, we tell the story of the Persian Gulf War through our collections and through soldier stories. And we don't start at August 2nd, 1990. We went back to World War I and the division of the division of the Middle East, you know, with regards to the Paris Peace Conference. And we look at the story of a World War I United States military observer attached to the British and his observations in the Middle East. And we like to bring our audience some knowledge, you know, a bit of background for those that really maybe not, don't understand the expanse of the Army and our history, and show that we have been in the Middle East and Southwest Asia, and we show that through the Persian Gulf Command in during World War II. We show that through the rapid deployment forces and through our presence and our exercises in the Sinai, the multinational force and observers. We also talk about what's going on politically as well that influences the Army and some of the huge doctrinal changes and in training, what the force looks like that we'll touch on in this discussion. And then we go to the deployment of first our 18th Airborne Corps and then 7th Corps in support of Desert Shield and Desert Storm. And we take a look at that huge movement. But Jay, I want to tell our audience, one of the big things that a lot of us, when we were thinking about this exhibition, the big misconceptions, and I know our guest, Jeff Hawks, will talk about this as well, is this idea that the war was easy. And this is one of the main things that we wanted to explain, that it wasn't easy. And one of our jumping off points was Schwarzkopf had given this talk, a 10-year commemoration of the Gulf War. And, you know, he says, this is a point that a lot of people forget when they talk about how easy it was. He says, this is exactly the war that the United States military had been training to fight for 40 years. For 40 years, we had expected to fight outmanned. We'd expected to fight an organization containing military Soviet, mainly military Soviet equipment. We'd expected to fight major tank battles across broad plains. The only difference was we expected to fight the Russians over the plains of Europe rather than the Iraqis in the deserts of the Middle East. This was the war we had planned to fight. Was it easy? And he said, no, it wasn't easy. But let me tell you, we were damn good. And that's kind of our jumping off point to have our audience imagine what it's like to deploy all of these soldiers, all of this equipment, to and what led to a successful four-day ground war, and to highlight that with soldier stories. And it we take it through the end of the war, the ceasefire, and then we also talk about what was going on at home as well.
Great. I'm looking forward to getting out there, and I'm sure there's many other things there too would all enjoy looking at.
Yes.
Jeff, why don't you tell us about the Army Heritage Center Foundation. What is it, and how does it fulfill the educational function of the Army War College?
Sure. Well, the Army Heritage Center Foundation is the nonprofit's friends group for the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center. We exist. Our primary mission is to raise the funds to build the building and expand the campus. We've done tens of millions of dollars worth of construction on site. We built the Visitor and Education Center where the exhibit is now housed. My role as the education director within that organization is to reach out and engage audiences that are not the typical target of the War College's educational programs. So I work a lot with teachers. I work a lot with high school and middle school students. I also do a lot of veterans outreach. And the idea is the center here, this is a national treasure. We've got over 15 million documents, photographs, and artifacts, unique historical items, over 500 general officer collections. We have a collection of oral histories of every company commander who served in Vietnam. We have General William Westmoreland's collection. We have Omar Bradley's collection. We have Brigadier General Anna Mae Hayes, the first female general's collection. We have Brigadier General Benjamin Oliver Davis, the first African-American general. So this is a national treasure. It's an unparalleled historical resource. And we're just delighted to share it with people and let the American public know that anybody can come here and do research. You don't need, well, now during COVID you do, but hopefully when COVID's over, you'll be able to return to walk-in status. But anybody can call ahead, make an appointment, come in, look at the catalog online, figure out what materials they want to look at, and come in and take a look at them.
So do people who have something to add volunteer their archives to you? And are you doing anything in terms of oral history with the people who've had these experiences?
Yeah, absolutely. I run an oral history program. I do oral histories myself, but my primary effort is the Veterans Oral History Program. We work with high school students and we train them to conduct oral histories. And it's really a great opportunity because it gives the students an opportunity to interact with veterans, many of whom we have a widening civilian military gap in this country. That's another, you know, thing of tremendous value about the center is making those stories available to the public and helping to bridge that gap. But we put our students in a room with veterans. They tell their stories. The veterans get honored. Most of these veterans are folks who nobody would ever have thought to do an oral history of them otherwise. We'll interview anybody from privates up to generals. And so, you know, it's just a fantastic opportunity for the public to get involved. And so anybody who wants to get involved, teachers who are watching, students who are watching, veterans who are watching, who want to do an interview, please reach out to us. You know, we have a bit of a waiting list. We'll put you on the list and we'll get to you in your turn.
Well, spoiler alert, we are going to later in this show have some personal stories of soldiers after we talk about the overview of the operation. It's, as Molly pointed out, it's been a while, and even though those of us who were following that closely have a lot to learn about Operation Desert Storm and maybe need to be reminded of some things. As I was when I did some research getting ready for the show, I learned quite a lot. And so why don't the two of you walk us through Operation Desert Storm? You know, what actually happened? What were the events? And then we'll talk about the reactions of the soldiers who were participating in this.
Well, The main overview is that the whole thing started when Saddam Hussein decided that he wanted Kuwait, and he went in and he took it August 2nd, 1990, and with the Cold War winding down, the U.S. forging a new role in international relations. There was a lot of uncertainty at the time. But one thing that wasn't uncertain was that the world wasn't going to sit by and let that happen. And that's when George Bush made the famous quote that this will not stand. And we there's really several phases to the program, to the operation. The first was the defensive stage of Operation Desert Shield, where the troops were sent over to protect the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in case the Iraqis decided to go further. And then there was the Operation Desert Storm, which was the liberation of Kuwait. That tends to get most of the attention because it was the offensive part. But it's important to remember that for 5 months, the 82nd and the 101st Airborne were out there more or less on their own. The veterans refer to themselves as a speed bump. They were there as a sign of our commitment. And to do everything they could to slow the Iraqis down if they decided to go for Riyadh. So yeah, Molly, what do you want to add to that?
Yeah, the idea that it's, you know, it's this, these different phases, but you know, when we deploy in August of 18th Airborne Corps, it's not soon after that deployment that we start looking for, you know, that General Schwarzkopf, the CENTCOM commander, starts looking for an offensive option, and the planners come out and they start looking at the terrain. They start looking at what is this going to take if these resolutions are not met by Iraq. What's the plan? And you know, they had a plan, but they looked at the battlefield, And that's when in November, 7th Corps was deployed from Europe. And Jeff brought up a good point. There's a lot going on in the world for those of us who are over 30 years old. We remember the fall of the Berlin Wall. And this kind of changes the strategic situation in the world and allows, you know, 7th Corps, we're not, you know, the Soviets are not a focus at the way they were in the past, and it allows for the deployment of 7th Corps out of Germany, which, you know, had been trained in armor, you know, like the armor training alone over wide plains, like I mentioned with Schwarzkopf, you know, is now applied in a desert situation. And so then we move on to the air war, and then the ground war, and then the ceasefire. So
may I circle back? This is fascinating. So the Desert Shield part of it was, first of all, to move in some quick reaction forces, including the Marine Corps, who were there early.
Absolutely.
And then lighter forces from the Army. And these would not have been adequate, probably, to push him out. But it takes time to deploy large, heavy armored forces, which would be necessary. And so at the same time as we were protecting Saudi Arabia, it was giving time for the Army to deploy. And from what I hear you saying, and I think you're right, that the idea, the general tactics were well understood, because we took tactics that were developed after Vietnam to work against the Soviets, and we applied those in the desert against Saddam Hussein. So we had a general idea of how to operationalize this, but this gave us time to get our act together, and most importantly, to get really heavy army forces over there on the ground. May I ask, had Saudi Arabia preparations with airfields and such made it easier for us to do this? Were they ready to receive the airplanes and the army and the forces when they came?
You know, I think that's, I want to go back, just back up a little bit, and what you said about getting ready. And that's really an important piece. What happened over there was really the result of 17 plus years of planning, as the Army was redesigning itself after the Vietnam War. And so a lot of the pieces and a lot of the parts of this were the development of the new weapon systems that were tested throughout the 70s and the 80s, the development of new strategy and tactics. A lot of it came out of the 1973 Yom Kippur War, when we realized the power of the new technological battlefield and realized that we needed to have, because we were going to fight outnumbered against the Soviets, and because the new weapons were so lethal, we had to completely dominate the battlefield in terms of lethality. Because if we tried to go man for man against the Soviets, we wouldn't stand a chance. And so we were ready for this. We developed a new kind of war fighting. We developed a new kind of way of thinking about warfare, where army planners actually determined a way to make sure that they weren't planning to fight the next war, but, or the last war, the old adage says, but the next war. And so, you know, for example, the heavy movement, well, we rehearsed that year after year after year with Reforger, sending troops, sending, getting heavy equipment moved around the world. So, you know, when the time came, we were ready to go.
At the same time, naval forces arrived, and they weren't much on television in the war because they were offshore. There were also other tasks to be performed, such as anti-mine operations and such. Well, the stage is set. So the civilian authorities decide that it's time to go. What is their plan, and how was it implemented?
You know, Jay, to follow up both on both points, it's, you know, the story is now, it becomes fascinating, because you asked if, like, how was it to be received, you know, this the Army, and Jeff can speak to this, as you know, he's a veteran, you know, he boots on the ground there during the Gulf War. But the logistics alone is a fascinating. I mean, it's just hearing what Lieutenant General Progonis ran the logistics effort there. And, you know, for our audience to think of, like, you know, almost 700,000 allied troops, you know, over, you're getting sent over 7,000 miles and 12,000 sea miles, like 6.5 million tons of equipment. And how does that happen? And it was all unfolding. You know, Saudi Arabia, they had some things set, but these really, it turns out, you know, really resourceful soldiers figuring things out, like contracting, like just heavy equipment transports, you know, to unload, and like all the work that's done at the ports, and then the movement from the port into Saudi Arabia, but then also the movement of all of this equipment to the line of departure when the ground war starts, like all of these aspects and setting up logistics bases. And, you know, if you can imagine an armored force driving across the desert, the amount of fuel and like the amount of soldiers refueling their tanks, like following with them, it's amazing. And it's something that we really wanted to highlight in the exhibition as well, just the effort, the monumental effort of, and Jay, like you said, the ships bringing things over, and then what they had, what they didn't have, and a lot in the resourcefulness of the soldiers to fill in. Sometimes there were big gaps. Sometimes, you know, the ones that arrived, the 18th Airborne Corps soldiers, had a lot of things to figure out when they got there, and the stories are amazing. And Jeff, I'm sure your experience there as well, what you saw on the ground.
Sure. Well, okay, so the question is, you know, how does this thing proceed? Well, I think it's important to understand that it really started at the top. President Bush developed a clear strategic vision. He knew what he wanted to accomplish, because at the end of the day, the military is a tool to accomplish our political goals. And the military's job is to fight and win our wars when the politicians decide we're going to fight one. But if you don't have that political goal, if you don't know what it is that you're going to do, and I think, you know, recently speaking with General Franks, who commanded 7th Corps, you know, he said we had that. We had a clear strategic vision. He was a Vietnam veteran, and he said the contrast was sharp. We knew what our goal was. And then the leadership was able to transform that into achievable military goals. So you had the strategic vision transformed into these achievable military goals. They were given the necessary resources to do it, and they had an exit strategy. We know when we're going to be done and when it's time to pack up and go home. As far as what they did in theater, there really are others who are more qualified to answer that question than I am. But I think I can give the general overall view of it, which is we realized we understood American doctrine, air, land, battle. The enemy can't fight back if they lack the capacity. And so it is less a strategy of attrition, of killing enemy soldiers, than it is of destroying their command and control facilities, cutting off their units so they can't see what's going on. They can't communicate with higher headquarters to get updates, to paralyze them by the destruction of their infrastructure. And so that was really, you know, they started out with a brilliant air campaign, pounded the Iraqis for over a month. And by the time it was time to move in with the ground forces, the initial units that they ran into, the guys on the border, who really, that's where the trouble would have started, is getting across that border. That's where there would have been a ton of trouble if they had been able to put up effective resistance at those fortifications. And so when that time came, they were cut off. They were demoralized. You talk to veterans and they say the guys they captured, they hadn't eaten in a while. They didn't have supplies, they didn't have equipment. And so they were ready to cave in when we gave them a good hard push. And then it was a matter of maneuvering out into the desert and engaging the Republican Guard, where things admittedly got a little bit more dicey as they got into the more capable units. But at that time, you know, the superior training of our troops, the superior equipment, just yeah, that made the difference.
Well, we'll talk about, or you will, talk about the left hook and Mali, the left hook that sort of outflanked and totally surprised the Republican Guard and the other forces there. Talk about the element of the coalition. We didn't go in here alone. It was important to get buy-in from other countries, especially Arab countries, to sort of legitimate what we were doing. And we had to find a way to coordinate with them. And my understanding is that we used some version of NATO procedures, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, that had been planned for war in Europe, used some version of that to as the basis of coordination with our allies. What can you say about the allies and their contribution?
Well, my perspective on that was as a soldier on the ground. And it was, and as an academic afterwards, studying political science, international relations. So as a soldier on the ground, it was remarkable. I have photographs in my personal collection I took of Soviet equipment, T-72 tanks. These were tanks that just 6 months ago I had been training to shoot at and learning the vulnerable points. And they were manned by Syrians. And when you think of that, as a growing up in the 80s, Syria was they were not the good guys. But here they are out in the desert with us, the Syrians. And I think I ran into some Egyptians. Of course, I had some nice interactions with the French, who, you know, we can always, you know, we've always been able to rely on France to be on our side. But so from a soldier's perspective, it was really remarkable to be out there. There was a lot done to make that coalition work. The diplomacy was phenomenal. George Bush understood the U.S. role in the new environment, the unipolar moment. Soviets are gone. The masterful job Saddam tried to drive a wedge in the coalition by attacking Israel, throwing the Scud missiles at Israel, and the masterful job, I think it was Secretary of State Baker, but don't quote me on that, but going to Israel and convincing them, hey, we'll protect you, we'll send the Patriot batteries to protect you, but you've got to stand down because your involvement will be very, very harmful to our coalition. And just the remarkable fact that we were invited in to Saudi Arabia. Now, I'm not sure people understand how what a huge thing that was. As I was traveling around that country, it's quite possible that I was one of the first Westerners. At one point, we drove all the way over to Jordan to pick up fuel. And I'm quite sure some of those people had never seen a Westerner before. So it was a remarkable diplomatic effort.
And it's one of those things, and I know we'll probably touch on this further in the discussion, that, you know, the Army War College uses the Gulf War as their case study for their capstone class. And one of the reasons that they use it is because, you know, they have... you know, their students represent only max about 60% can be Army, but other from other branches of the military, but other branches of the government. And, you know, this campaign, this war, you know, this diplomacy used, especially James Baker, in gathering a coalition of this size and significance, you know, what, you know, it becomes this instrument of war, and like how, and we couldn't have done it alone. And so just speaking to that level of government and how that intertwines with the, you know, with the Army, with, you know, the whole joint aspect is critical, you know, it's critical. It was critical to the success, but it's also becomes one of the big lessons learned of the Gulf War and the importance of this and how that, you know, the effectiveness of that tool and then a reason why that it's taught as well.
Well, we've talked a lot about logistics and the importance of it. No one could doubt it. Logisticians are want to say that amateurs talk about strategy and experts talk about logistics. That's maybe a little bit snarky, but let's turn to the tactics. So what was General Franks up to at this point? We're posed to go, we soft him up with bombing and off he goes. What happened?
Well, they made the breach and they got through the initial part of that. And that was really, everybody you talked to said we went earlier than we thought because it was just going better than they expected. What was really going on out there in the desert was, it was a couple of things. You know, you mentioned the left hook, and there came a point in the preparation where the information we started getting was that the Iraqis had no idea what our disposition was anymore. They had been expecting us to advance up the Wadi al-Batin, near Hafr al-Batin, and we had lined up there to make it look to them like that's what we were going to do. That's the traditional, it's in the desert, it was traditional to use something like a wadi, a big wadi, because it helps you navigate. And that's, you know, the desert had been swallowing up armies for thousands of years. And once we realized, okay, they don't really understand our disposition anymore, we can do this. We can flank them and hit them from an angle that they're not expecting. And part of the reason was that because we developed GPS, we were good at land navigation even without GPS. And we were able to maneuver through a desert that they were not expecting. So we got out there in the desert, and first we're going through these really secondary units that had old equipment. I interviewed veterans who were talking about running into T-54s, which at that time were you know, barely slightly more advanced than World War II tanks, going up against our brand new M1s. With our night vision and our capacity to bring in, you know, air superiority. So it was really a mismatch out there. We're bringing everything we've got to the party, and you know, maybe if they had been set up and better disposed, they could have put up more resistance. But we maneuvered it so that they weren't able to do so. So General Franks gets out there and looks right, and you know, sees the line clear, sees the forces that he wants to destroy, and they get themselves organized and they go, and you know, you have the largest tank battle that the United States Army has ever fought, and we just our superior training and our superior equipment just carries the day.
And just to follow up on Jeff's point too is, you know, what one thing we wanted our the audience to see, and when we talk about how the ground war unfolded, was that it was so many, it unfolded so differently for so many soldiers. So you have the soldiers of 7th Corps and doing, you know, coming around and doing the left hook, this like armor fist as they call it, but then, you know, you have soldiers coming up through Kuwait, and then you have the 101st and the air assault into Iraq. So all these movements, so the experience of the war is so varied for all the different soldiers. Mm-hmm. That's what makes it such a complex and interesting story. And all of that unleashing over a 4-day span of time, just it's riveting how it unfolded. And we have a big graphic in the exhibition to show just all of the different divisions, the units, and their movement, and how it unfolded for everybody differently, and so it lends itself to a very an incredible story.
Yeah.
So it's after 4 days, it's occurring even to Saddam Hussein that maybe he's in trouble. Talk about the last hours of the war and how it finally ended, and then the peace talk—not peace, but the surrender talks.
And you know what's interesting is at the end of the war, another thing we wanted to address, like you think 30 years ago, how information is disseminated, and you know, that a lot of the soldiers weren't sure that the war was over, and you know, with a very successful cutoff of Highway 8, and then the success of the armor fist and the push through Kuwait, but some of the soldiers, or the majority of them, you know, they're like, is the war over? You know, because things were unfolding in this huge expanse of space as well. I mean, if you think about the size of the battlefield, and so, you know, we say 100 hours, but for some of them, like, is it over? And you have some, like, the news anchors breaking it to them. Yeah. And, you know, in a world without, you know, cell phones and internet and email, how information disseminated. And then March 3rd, they call a ceasefire on it. And then March 3rd is when the ceasefire is negotiated. Well, the terms of the ceasefire are given to Iraq at Safwan. And And Jeff, I don't know if you want to follow up with that.
Yeah, so the soldiers, they're out there, and they're getting an idea of how well things are going, because they've been advancing rapidly. And there's this one last grab, this one last go for a bunch of territory. A lot of veterans have told me about that. And it's just sort of, look, we're gonna get this ceasefire. We're not sure how, if it's going to hold once we, because you know, that's something that we don't have a tremendous amount of experience in recent memory, but historically, yeah, you get a ceasefire and then the enemy uses that as an opportunity to regroup. Well, I guess we do have, because a Tet was supposed to be a ceasefire and didn't work out that way, famously. So they make one last grab to get as much territory as they can. We're trying to cut off as much of the Republican Guard as we can, make sure they don't escape. But also just so that we've got this land that if we need it, it's a strategic position for us to be in, and B, it's something that we might need to use as a bargaining chip if they get fidgety with the ceasefire. But as I understand it, when they finally came to negotiate this thing, General Schwarzkopf had to get a little rough with them and say, you either agree to the ceasefire or we're just going to cut loose and destroy everything you have. So I think it was an interesting thing, because all throughout Desert Storm, even to the end, I think there was a perception in the leadership in Iraq that America didn't have the resolve for this. I don't know why. So even after the crushing defeat, they're testing the limits. Is America really gonna put their foot down? And we did.
Yes. Well, let's move on to this issue, and we've covered it briefly. The Army learned some lessons in Vietnam, like, for example, they don't want to do unconventional warfare, and they preferred to do things that they were, you know, very good at, and a probably more important mission, which was to defend Western Europe from the Soviets. The lessons that they learned then were applied to this war. Is there anything else on that topic that we should cover before we move on to some personal stories of the soldiers? Because it's a fascinating background, and the Army took a hard look at things that went well and things that went wrong in Vietnam, and had a very thoroughgoing analysis of what to do better. And it's quite it's an example of a learning institution that is, I think, quite remarkable.
I think one of the things, and I recently had some conversations with General Franks that were just wonderful. And so I think one of the things that he wanted to stress is a lot of the senior leadership at that time were Vietnam veterans. He was certainly one. Some people don't know that he lost a leg in Vietnam and petitioned to continue to serve. And in fact, one of the items in our exhibit is the prosthetic leg that he wore as 7 Corps commander. I think General Franks talked about not getting tied up in the friction of military operations. That was the term he used. I refer to it as try not to get trapped by a solution. Keep your strategic goals, keep your tactical goals, but keep your objectives clear in your mind and focus on that, and do not allow yourself to get distracted by the minutia. And I think that was something that the Army learned, and certainly that generation of leader learned. Don't get sidetracked. Don't get off track worrying about this, worrying about that. You've got a job to do. Focus on getting that job done. When that job is done, then you can worry about other things. So I think that was something that really was at play here in this. And I think, you know, you go up to Colin Powell, who also was a Vietnam veteran and talked about it at length in his memoirs, said clear strategic goals, liberate Kuwait, then we're going home.
We'll circle back at, oh, excuse me, Mark, go ahead.
No, I just, and how that filtered down from the highest levels, like a clear, you know, with, which was, which, you know, this dialogue was started with General Meyer, Chief of Staff in 1980, he, you know, he's like the American people, like they, in order to have their support, you know, they need to understand the mission. Like they, it has to be a clear, you know, it, lessons learned from Vietnam, this idea of a clear mission. And we, you know, we speak about General Franks because one of the things that we have, that we incorporated into the exhibition was his commander's intent. And we hold his archival collection here at the center. And, you know, when I had interviewed him a year ago and I had asked him about it. And it's really cool because he carries his commander's intent that he wrote for 7th Corps with him to this day. Like, and so we have a copy of it. And he talks, so this idea of a clear intent that's pushed down to all the soldiers. So this intent is understood at every level. The soldiers understand what they're doing in any capacity. It's not just at the higher levels. And he was a real proponent of that. And it's something that he talks about to this day. And it was probably one of, I'd say one of his most valued documents, I mean, to carry it with you. And he uses it as a teaching tool and a leadership tool. And it's something we incorporated. And it was eye-opening to hear from, you know, a Corps commander's point of view about the clarity with his soldiers and how he executed that.
We talk about General Franks a lot. And that's because Molly and I both have a good working relationship. And I think personal relationship with him as well. He's a tremendous guy. But he is... also an extraordinarily humble soldier. And I think it's what makes him such a great leader. But he would be the first person to say that it was a team effort. And so we do bring him up a lot because he's the source of a lot of our information. But he'd be the first one to point out, says, hey, no. There were a lot of people working on this. It wasn't just me.
Well, this is a good example of harmony between the civilian leaders and the military leaders, where the intent of the civilians, backed up by the Army, was that this was going to be a limited war of limited objectives, and the objective was clear: liberate Kuwait and go home. We also beat up on the Republican Guard as much as we could while we were there, sort of looking toward the future. But I think I'd like to turn to some personal stories of soldiers for, you know, a few minutes, and then at the end let's circle back to what to me is the biggest difference between the Gulf One and Gulf Two. Was that in Gulf Two, we headed straight for Baghdad. And in Gulf One, we did not. And there's a lot of people who say, well, maybe we just should have taken him out while we could. And others have a different view. So let's hold that discussion for the last, just before the question and answers from the audience, if you don't mind. I know you have been gathering personal experiences of soldiers. Do you each have a story or two that would be of particular interest here at this setting?
I could think of so many, but I do have we highlight different, we tell the story of the Gulf War through different soldier stories in the exhibition. And and but just one thing for, I mentioned early on for our audience, and one thing we tried to, is if you think about how, like the amount of soldiers, over 500,000 U.S. soldiers serving, and how this experience has affected them, whether they went on to a career in the Army, because now we start seeing these junior NCOs, these junior officers now in major leadership positions. And one of my favorite stories too is we have, Major General Funk, who was the 3rd Armored Division commander, leading the largest armored division, an enormous armored division. But he deploys with his son, Captain Funk. And now Captain Funk is now General Funk, who is the director of TRADOC. But then also, his father-in-law is Lieutenant General John Yoslock, who's the 3rd Army commander. So we have three echelons, this family within three echelons. And it's not, it's not just them. So many soldiers deployed, it becomes a part of the memory. And like one of my favorite anecdotes is my sister, she works down at the Capitol, and she was at one of the the gentleman she works with, she was asking if something could be done. And, you know, he just kind of looked at her, he's like, I fed 60,000 soldiers in the desert. I could, you know, this is easy. And and just how this that experience has equipped. And you start talking about Desert Storm, and I was in it, my father was in it, my mother was in it. You start hearing of all, like, the amount of people that it affected and who were involved and how it developed them as leaders. Like our director, he was, you know, a young captain, and he was telling me all about deploying with the 101st and what it was like on the line of departure. Our facilities gentleman is, you know, he was over there, and Second Armor Division. Our reference desk, he was a chaplain's assistant, you know, our archivist in the vault, she went over with the 101st as well. And I mean, just they're everywhere, and they have this incredible story. So we brought some of those through, and those are some of my favorites. We have a corps commander, we have a division commander, we have an MP, a reserve component, a female soldier, we have special forces, we have a chaplain's assistant, and then we sell some. I know Jeff wanted to tell this story, but and we tell some of the tough, you know, when we talked to the soldiers, I was surprised at, you know, they're all very generous with their experience and in sharing to help inform us so we can inform the public and our audience. And it is surprising. One of the other themes, Jay, that we wanted to talk about was that this is, you know, this wasn't without consequence. Like this was hard on people to be in austere location, really tough environmental conditions, the strain and stress with very little communication, you know, from family, and how that played out and how that affected them. And, you know, we talk about medical effects, and it surprised me sometimes how painful the experience was at times. And then, you know, just this mix of emotion that really lends to the complexity of being a soldier and the humanity of it, which makes it just, you know, a riveting story to tell.
So, yes, indeed. Yeah. Jeff.
Yeah. So I just to touch a little bit on what Molly said, one of the things that's really interesting about Desert Storm, when I start meeting my fellow veterans, it was a compressed period of time. And the theater really wasn't that big. And so I think there's a very strong bond between the veterans of this conflict, because we were all there at the same time. We all and experiencing largely the same thing. So there's a real unity there. But the story I like to tell most is Colonel Frank Hancock and the first of the 327th Infantry, 101st Airborne. And I like to tell the story for a couple of reasons. And one is, of course, that the contributions of 18th Airborne Corps don't get as much press as the rest of the forces. They were out on the flank doing things that were important. But the other thing is because I think this story reveals something about the United States Army and the changes that it made and the Army it became. And Americans in general. So Frank was the battalion commander of the lead battalion of the 101st that was going to fly out to a place called Fob Cobra, about 100 miles behind enemy lines. And they were going to send up a resupply point so that the 101st could continue to leapfrog deeper into Iraq. And they were going to go out there and hold for 2 days until the supply trains and the 82nd caught up to them. And they had some French out to the side and the 24th Infantry Division. But it was the largest air assault mission ever. The farthest behind enemy lines. It was just huge. They're 48 hours out from the attack. Now, you have to understand, this is you have to remember, this is before cell phones, this is before email, this is before the internet. So communication, there is communication, but planning and organizing something like this is harder because you can't disseminate information as quickly as you can today. Today, a commander changes his mind. He just sends out a text message or a tweet or whatever he does, but he can send that information out very quickly. Well, they've been told that there is a trench line up on their objective. It's near a crossroads. It's a plateau. The terrain there is ideal for what they're trying to do, but there's a trench line up there. But they're told not to worry about it because that trench line is empty. Intel has confirmed they did a landing there, all that, it's empty. Well, the two Intel guys in Frank's battalion, he has a small intelligence section, they get concerned. And they start looking into it and they start digging deeper and they start thinking about it and they start asking questions. And finally they come to him and they said, Colonel, nobody builds a trench out in the middle of nowhere and doesn't put anybody in it. We think that trench is occupied. Okay. Frank says, what do you got? Now, right here, this is the United States Army at its finest. This is a captain and a sergeant. And Frank has gotten intelligence from CENTCOM. It's coming down from on high. And he says, okay, what do you got? He doesn't dismiss them. It's not like a bridge too far where they tell this guy, no, we're not going to listen to you. He says, show me what you got. And they convince him. And he goes and convinces his brigade commander. And he says, we've got to move the LZ back a mile, so that we're not landing right on top of this thing, because there might be somebody in there. And when they get there, there's 340 Iraqis in there, and they have four ZPU 57 millimeter anti-aircraft machine guns. Now, you got to think, what would those things do? A helicopter is never as vulnerable as when it's coming in for a landing. That first wave, those machine guns would have swept the sky. And it would have been potentially a catastrophe. And the story of Desert Storm would have been very, very different. It would have included this slaughter of American soldiers. And so we have this story where the initiative, the training of two soldiers, a young officer, a young NCO, who saw something that didn't seem right to them and asked questions. And then a bunch of senior officers who, when the word came up from below, said, maybe there's something to this. We should do something about this. I don't know if any other army in the world would have reacted that way. I don't know if the army pre-Vietnam would have reacted that way. But the changes, the character of American soldiers, the transition to the all-volunteer force and the professionalization of our soldiers, they're not just draftees anymore. They're the smartest, they're the best trained soldiers, and we listen to them. And that's one of the strengths, that was our strength over there in the Gulf, and that's our strength today. So I love to tell that story.
Well, it's a great story. One of the things that we thought when dealing with the Russians and also with the Iraqis was that there was not expected to be so much initiative at the lower level if you could cut them off. Well, I want to leave some time for questions from the audience. And so I would like you, Jeff, would you have a strong opinion on this? You believe that the limited goals were best and they shouldn't have tried to go to Baghdad. I wonder if you could just make that case quickly and then we're going to move on.
Sure. I think it's quite simple. The coalition wouldn't have held up. If we had made going to Baghdad and instituting regime change, the Egyptians would have bolted, the Syrians would have bolted, the Saudi Arabians would have really been uncomfortable if they were seen as, hey, you're letting the Americans use their base to take out an entire leadership of a country. I think we saw how much of a sticky wicket that was, because we eventually did go to Baghdad, and it was a lot harder. And we had the same breakneck advance across Iraq. That wasn't the problem. The problem was, what do you do afterwards? And so I think, you know, that going to Baghdad would have been one of those things where it's a way of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. So,
well, clearly we need to have another show on Gulf too, and I think we can look forward to that. Well, I appreciate your insights, and obviously there's a lot of lessons that have been learned, and sometimes the lessons people learn are the ones they wanted to learn when they went into it, and so we're never going to resolve, I think, some of these, but there's some wonderful stories, and it was a very proud moment for the Army and the country to have this kind of victory. And it had a great effect on the population, whose last memory of the military was Vietnam, which, despite individual heroics and battlefield successes, ended up not going as we hoped it would. So we have some questions from the audience, and Madeline Hutchins from the Pritzker Military Museum and Library will handle those, and then we'll come back for a conclusion. Maddie.
Wonderful. Thank you, Jay. I am excited that we've had some excellent questions today on our program. Thank you to all that have participated in that. One question in particular, it's kind of twofold for our guests today, was from a gentleman named Robert in Winnipeg. His comment was, I get the impression that coalition contributions were more important from a diplomatic legitimacy perspective than it was in the execution of military operations. Militarily, how would the US armed forces have fared without the military contributions of the coalition members? And really the overarching question with that was, from a military perspective, how important were the contributions of the coalition forces to the outcome of Desert Storm?
There are those who could answer that question better than I could, but I'll take a shot at it. The French, of course, were off on our flank, and my conversation with Colonel Hancock, he reminded me that there were some Iraqi forces coming down towards his position that were blocked. And so, it was blocked by a combination of the French. They had some help from the 82nd was there as well. And of course, the Air Force, our Air Armada helped put a stop to it too. But the 101st is a light infantry unit. And so how they would have fared against heavy Iraqi armor, who knows? We didn't have to find out. And part of the reason we didn't have to find out was because of our French allies. The forces that actually liberated Kuwait City were Arab, and they had support from the Marines, but they were Arab armies that went in. I think that was important, not just for diplomatic reasons, but also, it was a good tactic. It was a smart idea to do. Liberating a city is a messy business, and having troops local to the region, familiarity with the customs, familiarity with the language, just an opportunity to avoid all kinds of problems. Could we have done it without our allies? We certainly could not have done it without the, well, okay, could we have done, yes. Without the Saudis, of course, it would have been an entirely different ball game. It would have probably involved an amphibious landing. I don't want to get too much into counterfactuals, but that would have been extraordinarily difficult. The Saudis, of course, supplied us with millions of gallons of gasoline. And the coalition partners that also supported us, there were all these Japanese, I think, I forget what exact model, I think they were Nissans, but all these officers are driving around the country in these Japanese SUVs, because that was their contribution, among other things. So it was significant because the logistics was so difficult. We didn't have to move millions of gallons of gasoline. We got vehicles brought to us. We had assistance with feeding the troops. None of that is inconsequential, and all of it made our job easier. So militarily, could we have done it without the Allies? I'm sure we could have, but they sure made it a lot easier.
Just a follow-up to that too, Robert, great question. Like, if you start to, you think about how they interacted and, what the individual, but if you back up a bit and you look at the alliance and you look at the development of the alliance and what it's like to bring all these countries together in a coalition format that is effective and the strength of it. And, I saw this like firsthand when I worked at, U.S. Army Europe and working at a command level with training partners and the interaction between the soldiers, how important that is. I mean, alliances are maintained at all levels, but when you have soldiers training together, fighting together, it keeps the alliance strong. And this alliance, and in my opinion, is critical to the success of any military. And if we're taking a global view, then yes, the coalition was critical to on that level, and and maintaining a strategic situation. So,
I'm just also going to throw out one thing besides the diplomacy. There's a security issue here. If I remember correctly, Libya, I think Libya was the only country that supported Saddam in any way. And that was critical that George Bush was able to put that together, because without that consensus, where would we have been if the Syrians had said, hey, we got a problem with this? Well, they were behind us, more or less, to the north and behind us. That would have been a problem. So, you know, and we also basically had everybody else on board saying, hey, you're not going to have trouble elsewhere in the world while this is going on. So, you know, that is critical. We pulled a core out of Europe. That requires us an understanding that the Russians aren't going to do anything. So, you know, the diplomacy part bleeds into the military part quite a bit.
Maddie, any others?
We did have another question just in relation to what reading would you recommend on the Desert Storm?
Well, there's a number of publications put out by the U.S. Army that can be found on the Center of Military History's website. And if for our viewers, I was going to touch upon our exhibit is located online as well. If you go to our website, you can find it. And we have some resources as part of the virtual exhibit. But Certain Victory, Lucky War, Jayhawk, the U.S. Army and Desert Storm. I mean, I could think of six or seven that came out of the Army, and then lessons learned that will give our audience or any readers interested a nice background and foundation. And then you get into, like, you know, the really robust, you know, written by historians and this, but the Army has put out quite a few very informative and concise histories and analysis of the war.
Yeah, so I'm actually trying to pull up the link here for you because Colonel Hancock wrote an article about his experience, and I don't know if I can throw that in the chat box or not. I might be able to get it in there. Oh yes, looks like I can. So here we go. There's Colonel Hancock's book, and then Rick Atkins. I always forget if it's Rick Atkins or Atkinson.
Atkinson.
Atkinson wrote a book, and let me get the name of that for you as well, because that's also
Crusade,
the Untold Crusade. Story of the Persian Gulf War.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Molly. I'm not always the best at remembering. I remember the book. I don't necessarily remember the exact author or title's name. So I would look at those two as well. But yes, that Frank Hancock. It changed my view of the war. It helped me better understand that this was not an easy thing. We were that good. We were that good. We were that smart. And in some cases, we were that lucky. It could have easily been something very, very different. And unfortunately, I think one of the lessons that the American people have taken from this is that war can be fought at a distance with precision munitions. And we don't ever have to put our young men and now our young women in harm's way. And unfortunately, that's not the case. It's created an expectation that we can accomplish anything. And unfortunately, I think that engenders a little hubris at times.
Yes, that's an important lesson. The notion of the surgical strike is really a misnomer. I mean, even surgeons don't make surgical strikes. There's often collateral damage around the operating area. And if it's not important enough to risk that, you shouldn't be there at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, what was it, 98, 97% of the munitions expended in the war were dumb bombs. The smart weapons were a very small portion of what we actually used. They made for great television, and so they were overrepresented in the news reporting.
Yes. Well, let me say to thank you for tuning in this afternoon, and a special thanks to our guests, Jeff Hawks and Molly Bompain, for sharing their insights with us today. If you'd like to know more about the exhibit discussed in today's program, please visit their website, www.armyheritage.org, or feel free to email any further questions for Jeff and Molly via info@armyheritage.org. If you enjoyed this program and are looking for more engaging content, be sure to visit our website at www.pritzkermilitary.org for a list of free videos on a host of thought-provoking topics. If you are not a member of the museum and library already, please consider becoming one today. Our membership community is vital to supporting the activities that help fulfill our mission and vision. Thank you again for joining us today. And please watch for future programming.